Lars asked me to tell you a story that happened several years ago. I was speaking at a breakfast, and Lars was there setting up his book table, and there was a little old lady setting up place cards on the speaker's table, and he and she were chatting back and forth, and those of you that have chatted with Lars know that he's a joker, and I don't know what all they were joking about, but suddenly she turned to him and she said, "By the way, what's your name?" And he said, "Well, I'm an Elliot, too." He said this facetiously, of course, and I tell you this story because people do worry a lot about this business of my having one name and he having another one, and he does get called Mr. Elliot quite often. So he said, "I'm an Elliot, too." And she said, "Oh, are you the speaker's husband?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, that's funny. They told me that you had a different name." And he said, "Well, that's true, really." He said, "My name is Gren, G-R-E-N. But," he said, "you know, I am Elizabeth's third husband." And her face fell. And she said, "Oh, my goodness, I've only got one place card." And Lars said, "Well, relax." He said, "You know, the other two husbands are dead. I don't think they're going to show up." And in all seriousness, I mean, this lady was dead serious. She said, Oh, well, then it'll be okay, won't it?" So if you're worried about Lars's self-image, which people often do worry about, you can relax. He says, I don't have one. So it's never any problem for him. I want to talk just about servanthood this morning. And I know that our time is short. I thought it was supposed to be over at 11:45. Jeannie tells me 11:45, so if you need to leave, well, you go right ahead. Back when I was a student in college, I had a wonderful house mother. She was one of those women who gave herself to God. She was she came from Georgia, from a very blue-blooded southern family, a house with big white columns and servants. And when she became a Christian, she was disinherited by her family. So, although she had been reared to be a Southern belle, never thought of having to support herself in any way, there she was, out of a job, as it were, with no money and no place to go, because she was a Christian. She had no skills and no way of earning a living. Well, I don't really know how she earned a living between that time and when she became the house mother at the college where I was, but I was one of the very fortunate women who lived in her dormitory. Her name was Catherine Cumming, and Miss Cumming was a little short lady with a wonderful Georgian accent and a very ample bosom and a very charming and winning way of clasping this bosom in a way which I cannot possibly demonstrate. And she always called me Betty. Now, my name was Betty in those days. Anybody who has known me more than 25 years is allowed to call me that, although I've always felt that it was the poorest of all possible choices of a nickname for Elizabeth. I think Elizabeth is a nice name, and my parents named me after the Elizabeth in the Bible. That's why it's spelled with an S, in the King James Bible, that is. But they called me, my mother called me Betts, my father called me Betsy, my brothers called me Betty, and lots of other people did. So Miss Cumming used her Georgia accent, of course, and called me Betty. And I used to go in and talk with her, and I would pour out my troubles to her, and every once in a while she'd tell me some of her troubles in being the house mother in a college women's dormitory. It was a 24-hour-a-day job, 7 days a week. And one day she said, "Oh, Betty, I came to Wheaton to be a spiritual counselor. But here I am carrying mops and toilet paper across the campus." And I thought of that little lady and the kind of background she had come from. She had certainly never carried mops and toilet paper anywhere. Somebody else was paid to do that in her home. And having the desire to serve the Lord and to do something spiritual, she had come to Wheaton College to be a spiritual counselor, and here she was carrying mops and toilet paper across the campus. Well, years later, I went to visit Miss Cumming in the retirement home in Florida where she was, And I reminded her of what she had said to me that day. And I'll never forget how she blushed to the roots of her then pure white hair. And she clasped her less than ample bosom. And she said, "Oh, Betty, did I really say that?" And I said, "Yes, that is exactly what you said. And it was a tremendous lesson to me. To think that a woman of your status would be willing to be a house mother and to step down from your own personal ambitions of being a spiritual counselor and carry mops and toilet paper across the campus." Now, it was certainly true that she had been a spiritual counselor to me and to hundreds of other women. God had given her that privilege. But there is no doubt in my mind, and I'm sure I told her this, that her spiritual counseling amounted to a great deal more to all of us, because she was willing to be a humble servant. And she said, "Oh, baby, just think of the mercy of God that He allowed me to do that for Him." Now, that is servanthood. The willingness to do the lowest, humblest, dirtiest, most unappreciated and thankless job. And my heart said amen when Beverly was saying how difficult it is to find somebody who is willing to be a servant. In fact, I've heard that we don't call them secretaries anymore. They are administrative assistants. You know, there aren't garbage men anymore. There are, what is the word? Sanitary engineers, and janitors are something else. You know, everybody has to have a euphemism. And Amy Carmichael said that there is no calculating the value of someone who will come to the mission field to do whatever needs to be done without worrying about what we would nowadays call a job description. There was no such thing in her day. And on her questionnaire that she sent to prospective recruits, she was very careful to emphasize, "We can offer you nothing in the way of glamour or excitement or even interesting work. We can offer you a little pile of red sand in the southern tip of India, a place to die." A chance to die was one of her favorite expressions. Don't come unless you're willing to do whatever is needed. Now, that's really what a mother is, isn't it? A mother's job description would fill many pages if we were to write down everything that she's expected to do, but basically, she's just there to do whatever needs to be done, from chauffeuring to cleaning up messes. She's there to be available and to do anything that needs to be done. You remember that when Jesus was speaking with his disciples just before he was crucified, a jealous argument broke out among them as to who was going to rank the highest among the disciples. There's nothing new about this greedy desire to upgrade our lifestyle. Who was going to be the highest disciple? And Jesus said, "In the world, kings lord it over their subjects, and those in authority are called their country's benefactors. Not so with you. On the contrary, the highest among you must bear himself like the youngest, the chief of you like a servant. For who is greater, the one who sits at table or the servant who waits on him? Surely the one who sits at table. Yet here I am among you like a servant." What did Jesus do? He took a towel and got down on his hands and knees and washed the feet of his disciples. And it says in John 13 that he did this to show the full extent of his love. Now, for 3 years of public ministry, he had been demonstrating his love in many ways. And here he was at the end of his public ministry, And he was going to the cross, where he certainly knew that he would be able to show the full extent of his love. But what was he doing? He was graphically dramatizing for his disciples the kind of thing that servanthood was meant to be for them. They were certainly not all going to be crucified. Tradition says that some of them were. At least one of them, tradition says, upside down. So he was not saying everybody is going to have the opportunity to die a dramatic and horrible public death on a cross. But he was saying, if I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you must wash one another's feet. Now, in our culture, we don't need to wash the feet of every guest who arrives. It doesn't happen to be the sign of courtesy anymore. We wear shoes, for one thing. We don't walk in dusty, stony paths. And so it just isn't necessary. But normally we do offer somebody a drink of something, a cup of coffee or a cold drink or something. You give them a chair to sit in. You offer them a place to wash their hands. These are ordinary courtesies. And Jesus demonstrated by doing the job of the lowest slave in an Eastern household the kind of thing that he meant. The servant is not greater than his Lord. And you remember the disciples called him Lord, and Jesus said, you call me Master and Lord, and you say well, for so I am. And so he was not abdicating his position that God had given him as Lord and Master. But if I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, then you must wash one another's feet. I plead this morning for the Christian women who are prepared to wash feet. That is, to have no ambition of notoriety or recognition or thanks. Are you the kind that says, well, I work my fingers to the bone for this church, and what kind of thanks do I get? What kind of thanks are you looking for? What is spiritual work? Amy Carmichael went to India as a missionary and for 6 or 7 years traveled as an itinerant evangelist, and a very effective one. She gathered around her a group of dedicated young Indian women, and they traveled together in the most uncomfortable method of transportation imaginable, outside of a wheelbarrow of China. They traveled in what were called bullock bandies, just terrible springless wooden carts. My husband and I had the chance to ride for about 10 minutes in one of those, and 10 minutes was about 9 minutes too much. And she traveled for weeks and weeks on end that way, and she had a very effective ministry as an evangelist, but God tied her feet, and she became a mother to a family of 900. And this meant diapers and bottles and getting up at night. You can read her story. But she saw the diaper washing and the bottle feeding as spiritual work. Every bit as spiritual as traveling as an evangelist. It took her a while to see that, but she learned that lesson that every godly woman has got to learn. People look at me and people who sing and people who have visible ministry, and they say, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to speak? Wouldn't it be marvelous to be able to write books? I really don't believe that God is more interested in my standing on a platform or sitting at my computer writing a book than he is in the way I iron Lars's shirts and the spirit with which I clean the bathroom and the faith by which I go to the grocery store. Every single thing that I do is meant to be an offering to Jesus Christ. Jesus said, I do always those things that please the Father. And sometimes he sat down because he was tired and thereby pleased the Father. And sometimes he healed the sick and raised the dead and pleased the Father, and sometimes he washed feet and thereby pleased the Father. I want to tell you about four Catherines in my life, and I wish I could tell you more about each one, but time doesn't permit this. Four of the many spiritual mothers whom God has given me, and I've referred to Amy Carmichael as one of my great spiritual mothers, although I never met her. She was in India for 53 years until she died, and so I never saw her. But I know four women whose names all happened to be Catherine. The first was my own mother. And my mother graduated from an exclusive private school in Philadelphia as Spoon Girl. The most outstanding man in the class, boy in the class, was called Cane Man. And in her class, the Cane Man was Leonard Carmichael, who became the president of the Smithsonian Institution. The most outstanding girl in the class was the Spoon Girl, and she was presented with a very beautiful silver spoon with an ebony handle, which I used to have until my house was robbed and it got stolen. But my mother was an outstanding girl. She was a very popular girl. She had a number of proposals. She was one of the first women drivers in Philadelphia. Her father had plenty of money, and he bought her a Buick car, and she really cut a figure. She had a gorgeous beaver hat and a beaver coat, and she, being a female driver in the first place, was just a phenomenon. So there are all kinds of ways in which my mother was outstanding, but it never crossed her mind that she had any job other than being her husband's wife and her children's mother. And she was the mother of six of us, and she was always there. She did nothing else outside of the home. Now, I'm not telling you that it's wrong to do anything else outside of the home. I'm simply saying that that was her job, and it was taken for granted that that ought to be enough for any woman to do. Now, later on, when her children were grown and gone, then she took on some spiritual children. And she became a Bible teacher for many young women and helped young women with the rearing of their children. And I've had letters from some of those since my mother died in 1987 telling me that she was a spiritual mother to them. I think of Catherine Cumming, that wonderful little lady from Georgia, a spiritual mother who was prepared to do what was anything but spiritual work in the eyes of others, for God's sake and for the sake of us women in that dormitory. I think of Catherine Cunningham. Miss Cumming was Catherine Cumming, I think I said that. And then when I went to Bible school way out on the prairies, the bleak, frozen prairies of Alberta, I had finished college and went out there to have 1 year of Bible study before I became a missionary, and I was extremely lonely. I felt like a fish out of water. This was a strange place where they had 32 pages of rules. One of them was that we were not allowed to wear sleeves above the elbow. We were not allowed to cut our hair. There was no jewelry. There was no makeup. Our skirts were measured X number of inches from the ground, depending on how tall we were, and we had no running water. There were 1,600 people there. They had to truck the water across the prairies every day, and we were allowed to go and get water in a bucket from a certain spigot at a certain time to make sure that we didn't meet any of the men students there, because the men had to get their water at one time and the women at another time so that we wouldn't speak to each other. Anyway, there were a lot of reasons why I felt like a fish out of water and felt very lonely, and one day there was a knock on my door, and I opened the door to see this radiant face, an old lady with white hair and the pink cheeks and just the most beautiful smile. And she said, "Oh, Betty dear," she had a Scottish accent, "you don't know me, but I know you, and I've been praying for you, dear girlie." Well, I don't know why she was praying for me. She was a staff member's wife, and she went to the staff prayer meetings, and for some reason she had picked me out of all those 1,600 students, and she had been praying for me. And she said, "I just want you to know that I live down the street here, and if you ever want a cup of tea and a Scottish scone, just pop by my little apartment." Well, you could be sure that I popped by Mom Cunningham's little apartment many times and drank many cups of that delicious Scottish tea and ate her home-baked Scottish scones. And she listened to my troubles. And I was madly in love with a man named Jim Elliott, and he was still in college, and I was way out here, thousands of miles away. And I didn't think I was ever going to see him again, and I was hoping that someday we might get married. And so dear Mom Cunningham began to pray with me and encourage me and support me with scripture and cheer me in a thousand ways. And after I left that school, she continued to pray for me, and she wrote me letters, and every single letter she ever wrote me, I think she quoted Romans 15:13, "May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope." Now, Mom Cunningham knew that I was of a very melancholic temperament, naturally speaking. And I'm sure that it was not for nothing that she picked that particular verse. And I can see that her prayers are being answered after all these many years. And she has been with the Lord for many years. Dear Mom Cunningham, the third Catherine in my life. And then, after that experience, I met a returned missionary from Colombia. She was just on furlough. She was not retired, named Catherine Morgan. And Catherine Morgan was a widow whose husband had been killed in Colombia, and she had carried on her missionary work with four little girls. The oldest, I think, was four or five when her husband died. And Catherine Morgan is still in Colombia, living in one of the most dangerous cities in the world, Bogota. And she has open house for everybody from lepers and the insane to criminals and drug addicts and everything you can imagine. Wherever Catherine Morgan is, that is home for all kinds of people. And she has done this for 52 years. She's in her 80s now, and she is still a full-time missionary. And she told me that among the jobs that she has is one Bible class in her home, another Bible class all the way across the city, and she rides public transportation to get there. She has a stream of people coming to her door to pray with them. She has a telephone ministry of people needing counseling. She goes to the prisons and visits prisoners. And then in her spare time, she visits the old folks. Mind you, she is, I think, 81. But she has a ministry to the old folks, a spiritual mother. I have spoken many times on the subject of spiritual motherhood, and I've had young women come up to me and say, "Where can I find a spiritual mother?" And I say, "Well, you can pray for one, but the most important thing for you to do is to be a spiritual mother." "Oh, but I'm only 32, or I'm only 25, they say. "Well, don't forget, younger women are looking to you for an example. And if you're 16, the same thing is true. My idol when I was 9 years old was my 15-year-old neighbor, Ruth Ritchie. And I wanted to do everything exactly the way Ruth did it. I wanted to look like her and walk like her and fix my hair like her and talk like her. And she was a godly Christian girl who had time for a 9-year-old kid. Not very many 15-year-old girls are going to bother with a 9-year-old neighbor. But I think of this passage in the same book that we've used as our theme for this conference, second chapter of Titus. Paul tells this young pastor that he is to teach the older women to be reverent in their bearing, not scandalmongers or gossips, or slaves to strong drink, and we might say addicts to anything. I don't think we need to rule out any beverage that we may be dependent upon here. They must set a high standard and school the younger women to be loving wives and mothers, temperate, chaste, and kind, busy at home, respecting the authority of their own husbands. Thus the gospel will not be brought into disrepute. Now this word schooling the younger women does not mean start a school or teach a seminar or give a lecture. It means to teach by example. And my life has been unspeakably enriched by the examples of Catherine Howard, my mother, Catherine Cumming, my house mother. Catherine Cunningham, that wonderful woman at Bible school. And Catherine Morgan, who was really responsible for booting me to Ecuador. And when she heard on her radio that 5 American missionaries had been killed, she sat there trembling, waiting to hear the names. And she got in her pickup truck, and she drove from Colombia to Ecuador to be with us widows. And she fed our babies, and she comforted us, and she told us jokes, and she just cheered us up. I mean, she's a no-nonsense kind of a person with a tremendous sense of humor. And I said, I remember one night at supper, she was there during that agonizing week when we still weren't sure whether they were dead or alive. I said, you know, if we knew that the Lord was coming on Saturday, then this would be no problem at all, would it? And she said, yes, girls, that's exactly what got me through 15 years ago. And I said, now, Catherine, you didn't really need to remind us that it's been 15 years. You mean we might have to live through 15 years without our husbands? Well, that's the way she was, just buoyant and joking, and she did wonderful things for us. A spiritual mother. And I see middle-aged women whose children have grown up and gone, and now they're being told by the world and, to my sorrow, by the church, it's your turn to do something for yourself. You've been giving yourself to these children, and now you owe it to yourself to do something for yourself. Go on a cruise, go back to school, get another degree, learn underwater basket weaving, whatever. And the younger women who desperately need your mothering, because 9 times out of 10, their own mothers are not around. You know, I live 3,000 miles away from my daughter. And I want to kiss the feet of those women in Southern California who have called her up and said, can I take your children today? Or can I come over to your house and stay with your children while you go shopping? Where are the servants? I would recommend to every one of you who has ears to hear that you start a WOTT group. W-O-T-T, in your church. Women of Titus 2. You can be called the Watts. Now, these are women who will clean refrigerators. You will call up that young mother who you know perfectly well. She manages to clothe and feed the children and put them to bed and do the laundry. Can she clean the refrigerator? Does she have time to clean the oven? When's the last time she scrubbed the shower? Who washes the windows? She can't afford to get professional help. Why aren't we doing these things? When I go to my daughter's house, the first thing I do is say, give me the list. And of course, I love doing those things for her because she's my daughter. I wouldn't love it quite so much if it was just the neighbor down the street. But Valerie's neighbors, the people in her church, some of them are real spiritual mothers. We are to teach the younger women by example to be loving wives, to be loving mothers, to be reverent, not to be gossips, not to be addicts, to be women of self-control, pure, kind, busy at home. I would ask you solemnly before God to ask Him, what will you have me do, Lord? If there's one woman that I can pray for or write a note to or call up or whose refrigerator I could clean, if there's somebody, maybe it's only one person, maybe there are 10 people that God wants you to minister to, and you're not going to get any medals for this, but I do believe that the day may come when the Lord will look at you with love in His eyes and say, well done, good and faithful career woman. What does He say? Good and faithful servant. God bless you.